From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
I regret that the effort to repeal and immediately replace the failures of Obamacare will not be successful. That doesn't mean we should give up.
A scramble in Washington over health care. A GOP replacement plan collapses, but Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he'll push for a vote to repeal Obamacare. Also today, in Massachusetts, Governor Baker wants to make significant changes to the state's Medicaid program. He's given lawmakers 2 months to reconsider his health care proposal.
These mass health reforms are necessary not only to balance this year's budget, but they're also necessary to ensure the health care safety net remains financially secure over time.
And with rampant inequality, education and jobs are held up as the great equalizer. But is it possible that they don't really solve the problem of poverty? All that and celebrating Jane Austen next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Things are happening very fast in Washington today, and that thing that's happening is basically nothing when it comes to Republican efforts to reform health care. GOP congressional leaders, stung from last night's collapse of the Senate health care reform bill, today dumped their Affordable Care Act replacement ambitions and floated the idea of simply repealing Obamacare. But even that effort is having trouble getting off the ground. Three Republican senators immediately said they'd vote against any repeal effort. But just a few minutes ago, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell told reporters he's undeterred.
Most of our members would like to vote on now, and we'll be doing that in the near future.
But earlier today, President Donald Trump seemed to be saying, forget repeal, forget replace, time to embrace retreat.
Let Obamacare fail. It'll be a lot easier. And I think we're probably in that position where we'll just let Obamacare fail. We're not going to own it. I'm not going to own it. I can tell you the Republicans are not going to own it. We'll let Obamacare fail, and then the Democrats are going to come to us, and they're going to say, how do we fix it? How do we fix it?
Well, joining us now is Matt Visor. He's Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Matt, it's good to have you back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay, so what exactly is going on right now in the halls of Congress? Are we or aren't we going to have a vote in the Senate on just a straight-up repeal bill on Obamacare?
Well, as you can hear from those past two clips, not everybody in Washington in the Republican Party is on the same page here. It is a striking moment. And it's striking for Mitch McConnell, too, who normally has a pretty iron grip on his caucus. And now there's multiple defections. There are at least three senators right now saying they will vote against a move to have a vote on a repeal of Obamacare.
Three Republican senators, right?
Three Republican senators, which means that he does not have the votes at this point, unless something changes. If he does bring that vote to the floor, it will not go forward.
Yeah.
So something needs to change in order for that to happen. And it's kind of a dicey moment for Mitch McConnell, who, again, normally is this sort of master legislator and now is experiencing defections from his own caucus.
Well, those Republican senators that I'm seeing include Shelley Capito of West Virginia, who put out a statement saying that she didn't come to the Senate to hurt people, and she thinks that a straight-up repeal could potentially hurt many West Virginians. Senator Susan Collins of Maine has said, I do not think that it's constructive to repeal a law that is so interwoven within our healthcare system without having a replacement plan in place. Also, Senator Murkowski of Alaska and possibly even Rob Portman of Ohio. So what exactly is Mitch McConnell trying to accomplish then by even hinting that he still might push for a vote?
Well, that's what's sort of baffling right now, is that he may be trying to call people's bluffs, but, you know, they have strength in numbers at this point where, you know, you'll remember a little bit a couple months ago where the House had a similar situation where they came up to a vote and Paul Ryan pulled the vote when it was clear that there were enough defections to where it was not going to pass. So Mitch McConnell may be rolling the dice a little bit here, trying to move toward a vote. Another potential theory is they do move a vote, it doesn't pass, and then that sort of demonstrates the lack of you know, ability to pass this. And then, you know, by Mitch McConnell's hope, he could move on to other items on the agenda. But it again, is sort of this moment where the blame game is starting very quickly here, with President Trump starting to point the finger at other people for the blame of healthcare the healthcare repeal bill not coming up.
I mean, it's interesting the whiplash that it seems that President Trump himself has gone through today, because earlier in the day he tweeted Republicans should just repeal failing Obamacare now and work on a healthcare plan that would start from a clean slate. But then you also heard that tape we just played, because not long after that tweet, he said, just let Obamacare fail. I mean, forget even trying to repeal it. So where has the president been today on this issue? I mean, I was reading that yesterday he was barely even told that that those three senators were going to vote no on the Senate health care reform plan.
Well, he had a dinner last night at the White House. He had seven senators there, all of whom are on board with health care. So it shows you know, he's not twisting the arms of Mike Lee and Jerry Moran, the two senators who came out against the bill. He's not courting them. He's not having them to the White House. He's having other senators. So the president has been quite disengaged on a lot of the details of this health care bill and of the push for it. He wants a victory, but he's not kind of getting involved in the selling of the bill to the public or in the backroom sort of arm twisting and trying to get people on board on this. So
yeah.
And it is sort of the centerpiece of his administration and his legislative agenda, the thing that he ran on and the thing that he talked about in rally after rally. So I think it is kind of a testing moment for him at this point.
Well, you know, we heard the president say that let Obamacare fail because he says it's already failing. To present all the analysis here, lots of independent organizations, including the Congressional Budget Office, have found that Obamacare isn't necessarily failing. The exchanges do deserve stabilizing and can be significantly shored up, but they say that it's not in a death spiral, as the president has said. But Matt, just a final question to you, where you had left off here. I mean, presuming that whether or not Mitch McConnell pushes for a vote on a straight-up repeal, it doesn't look like that's going to happen, that they're not going to be able to repeal Obamacare outright, at least today. I mean, where does this leave the GOP's effort? Has the moment passed for health care reform in the way that the GOP would have liked it?
Potentially, yeah. The question going forward is that everybody agrees that there are problems with our health care system. There's issues with Obamacare. There's things that need to be addressed and changed. Even hardcore Democrats would agree with that. So I think you're at a moment potentially of is there any sort of outreach that can be done, some bipartisan cooperation, which rarely happens in Washington these days, but has started happening a little bit. Susan Collins has been meeting with some Democrats. They're trying to come to agreement on some aspects that maybe both parties could sell as a victory. But right now, it's hard to sort of see the leadership taking that approach. McConnell has been reluctant. And Chuck Schumer has talked about wanting to work with Republicans, but in reality, there has not been a lot of bipartisan cooperation on this. But that could be the area where this heads, given that Republicans are very unlikely at this point to have the votes to repeal it outright.
Matt Visor, he's Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Matt, thank you as always.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's talk about the healthcare reform scene back here in Massachusetts. And that's because 40% of the state's budget is spent on just one program. So when you consider, for example, every $10 that the state spends, four of those dollars go to this one program, that program being MassHealth, the state's Medicaid program that provides subsidized health care coverage to low-income residents. And that program has been growing. It's projected to increase by $1.25 billion in fiscal year 2018. which means Governor Charlie Baker is concerned that at that growth rate, MassHealth won't be sustainable in the long run. So he's been pushing for some significant reforms. Back in June, he proposed a package including shifting some 140,000 low-income people from MassHealth onto commercial insurance plans. But Beacon Hill lawmakers pushed back on that and rejected many of the cost-curbing measures in the state's final budget, which the governor signed yesterday. But now, Baker isn't giving up on reforming MassHealth, and he has sent his proposals back to the legislature.
We heard their message that they wanted more time to discuss and understand the implications of it. These reforms are necessary to prevent an unfair burden on Massachusetts employers and healthcare providers.
So a lot of back and forth here about MassHealth, but one thing is for certain, there is a question about the long-term sustainability of this critical state program. So joining us to talk more about it is State Senator Jim Welch. He serves as the Senate Chair of the Joint Committee on Healthcare Financing. Senator Welch, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us is Josh Archambault. He's Senior Fellow on Healthcare Policy at the Pioneer Institute, and he's with us in the studio. Josh, welcome back to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Josh, let me just start with you. I mean, how would you frame what you see as the current problem or challenge MassHealth is facing? I mean, is it the same way that the governor sees it?
Yeah, well, certainly there's a hole when it comes down to it. And we've had a lot of people move onto the MassHealth program. Just for historical perspective, I went back and looked. 10 years ago, where were we? Well, we had about 1 million people on the program. Now we're close to 2 million people. So in essence, we've had a 90% increase in enrollment, but the cost of the program has gone up 130%. So we have a cost problem and an enrollment problem because of how many people. 1 in 4 citizens of the Commonwealth are on this program, a program that historically has been a safety net healthcare program. Now it's certainly crept up into a much larger portion of the population.
So before we get to prescriptions on how to fix it, Senator Welch, let me just ask you, I like to see how close or far apart guests are in terms of diagnosing a problem before we go straight to solutions here. I mean, do you see eye to eye with Josh that MassHealth is facing a cost and enrollment problem?
Well, I think, you know, there's definitely agreement upon, you know, the issues that are out there in terms of cost, and enrollment. Of course, those are areas that we want to address. I think it's more of a situation where how we get there and how we address them is really more of the situation that's at hand right now.
Okay, so let's talk specifically about what the governor had proposed, Josh. Because, for example, one of the things that the governor received some significant pushback on was he had the idea to add some assessments to businesses in order to help pay for this increased enrollment in MassHealth, right?
Yeah, and this is something that changed through this whole debate from his initial proposal to now. And business, by and large, went along with the end package because there were other reforms attached to it, other reforms to try to drive down healthcare costs. They also got relief in some other areas where they have to pay per employee assessments. So there was a comprehensive package, and I think the governor's position was you can't do one in isolation. You have to do them all together so that we can set ourselves up for at least a couple years of slowing healthcare growth. This problem isn't going to go away. It's really a matter of who's going to pay the bill. Is it going to be federal taxpayers or state taxpayers? And how do we make sure that the roughly 500,000 people that since the Affordable Care Act became law moved from employer-based insurance to MassHealth find their way back to employer-based insurance?
Okay, so that's an important point. Senator Welch, you've written about your concerns regarding the governor's proposals and the manner in which perhaps these proposals were made. I mean, walk us through some of your concerns. Why not try to encourage employees to use their employer-based healthcare programs? Is it not a problem that so many folks who have other options are moving into MassHealth?
No, I think we agree on that point. Okay. I think we want to see that shift, you know, move in the other direction. I think, you know, in, you know, our op-ed in the Globe, and I think what you were referring to, you know, how we had written about it the other day was really about the proposal that was made by the governor was very broad, had a lot of changes as part of it. But the way the process, you know, in terms of the legislative process that we go through, typically the budget process, the House you know, comes out with a budget proposal and votes on their budget proposal. The Senate comes out with their budget proposal, votes on their budget proposal. And we, through the conference committee, you know, a six-member conference committee, decide and then send that on to the governor. Well, the governor's proposal came in during that conference committee negotiation, which means that the whole House did not have opportunity to weigh in on it. The whole Senate did not have opportunity to weigh in on it, which means that our constituents in respect did not have opportunity to weigh in on those proposals, which I think gets at the heart of what we're trying to say, is that we need to slow down a little bit, make sure that all stakeholders are engaged in this process, and make sure that we do this the right way. We don't necessarily disagree with all of the governor's proposals. We just want to make sure that we're engaging all stakeholders and making sure especially the consumers and the public is engaged in a way that is appropriate and in my opinion, necessary.
Okay. So point taken. Let me just get Josh's response to that. Ultimately, policy proposals can be made, you know, hither and thither, but getting them passed on Beacon Hill is a different thing. I mean, you hear the senator calling for a more deliberative approach. Why not? I mean, especially when it comes to something as central to the state as healthcare.
Sure. And the senator's point is right, that there is a process for this. However, we face a $350 million hole in MassHealth, and for the legislature to expect business to start paying the tab without getting something in return. Now, look, I'm sure there's a compromise here where there's a expedited process to take an up and down vote on some of these reforms in the legislature, and I'll let the senator speak to how that could come to fruition or not. However, my deeper concern here is that in Massachusetts, we've been focused on two things for far too long. One, coverage. Not cost or access to health care. And the second one is accessing federal dollars. That has really been the focus here. And quite frankly, where we get the vast majority of savings here under the governor's proposal is cost shifting onto federal taxpayers. As a taxpayer who pays both state and federal taxes, that doesn't make me feel great at the end of the day, because somebody else is just paying for it. It doesn't go away. So we have to start focusing on how do we change healthcare so that people can get better value healthcare more easily. The problem with going through the legislative process is that the folks that usually show up are the special interests against it. And so ultimately, whether it's taxpayers or patients, we have to figure out a way to get to reform where those that are paying the bills, those that are paying the health insurance premiums, actually see some relief at the end of the day. Unfortunately, up till date, we have seen very little progress in the legislature to do so.
But I think the senator has been saying that that in order to get more more input from all stakeholders, all taxpayers, all healthcare recipients and users in Massachusetts beyond those special interests, that you can't do that at the speed that Governor Baker wanted to make these changes.
And that's a fair point. The issue here is who shows up to the State House every day. And the senator, to his credit, I mean, just led a special commission on price variation and gave an opportunity for lots of stakeholders to weigh in and identify some of the issues. And I think that there's low-hanging fruit here. I mean, in MassHealth, just as one minor example, we don't know if somebody is signed up on Medicaid in another state. So when we, in a managed care world, which is what the vast majority of people on MassHealth are on, we pay an insurance company a check every month. If they move to Rhode Island and sign up for Medicaid there, we might not know for 8 months, a year, or even longer. That's a huge problem and a complete waste of money. And I think that's the kind of low-hanging fruit that I think there's bipartisan support to get at.
Right.
We just need to figure out how quickly can we get there, because we face a huge hole in MassHealth.
Senator Welch, your thoughts?
Well, there's certainly low-hanging fruit. There's no question. But even the low-hanging fruit in healthcare is very difficult to find consensus on. I found that out during the budget process when it came to surprise billing and out-of-network billing. So, you know, I think we need to continue to move forward. I think both the House, the Senate, and the administration are focused on cost containment and taking that next step. I think we in the Senate are just really focused on making sure that we do it in a way that allows all ideas to get on the table. The Senate, through the leadership of Senate President Rosenberg, formed a working group last year to really start focusing on these ideas, well in advance of what is coming forward right now. And we have some ideas that we're going to be be moving forward with, that maybe be able to work in concert with the governor's proposals, in concert with some of the House proposals, and I think ultimately will be a better piece of legislation, a better change to policy.
Can you give us a small preview of the one or two of those ideas?
I can give you some general ideas. I mean, we focused some of the buckets, some of the areas that we focused on are hospital readmission, trying to get at hospital readmission, trying to get at some of the areas regarding long-term support services. Certainly the Senate president and the Senate in general, and I think everybody recognizes the fact that prescription drugs and the cost of prescription drugs is an area that we really want to focus on and really, really want to take the first step at getting at trying to reduce some of those costs. Mm. So those are some of the main areas I think that we're focused on in the Senate, and I know that the House and the administration also has ideas as well, and with mass health reforms, those are some areas I think that we can improve upon.
Senator, let me just jump in here because I want to ask you about what I heard Josh say is one of sort of his core concerns, that up until now the state has been really focused on expansion of coverage, for example, and turning to solutions which involve ultimately taxpayer subsidy or taxpayer support of some kind, whether it be at the state level or the federal level. And Josh, I don't want to be misrepresenting you here, but I heard you say that that's a concern, and perhaps we should be looking at other ways and other aspects of healthcare to reform. I mean, what's your response to that? That too often the state has looked to taxpayers in some way, shape, or form to shore up healthcare here.
Well, certainly, when we did healthcare reform in 2005, 2006, the focus was definitely, you know, certainly on access and quality, maintaining quality and increasing access. And for the past decade or the past 10 years, we've been focusing on cost containment, and we've been having limited success, but we have been having some success by certainly with the work of the Health Policy Commission and the setting of the growth benchmark across the Commonwealth has given a target for all stakeholders in healthcare to really shoot towards maintaining and reducing costs in healthcare. And I think we are making progress. There's no question about that. We have a long way to go, and we will continue to have a long way to go. Healthcare is not something that you can press one button and all of a sudden it's going to be fixed. We have to continue to work on it. We have to do everything we can to make sure that there is stability in the market, but we have to continue to work forward.
Josh, before I run out of too much time here, I mean, I don't think I ever heard anyone say that you could achieve coverage expansion and, you know, significant cost control at the same time, that coverage was the first priority, cost control would come later. And we're sort of in that second period now. I mean, there's even been a move to shift MassHealth to an accountable care model, right, where physicians get paid to keep their patients healthy and not traditional fee for service. So aren't we kind of right where we need to be in terms of the big, long process of healthcare reform?
No, the bigger issue is the theory didn't prove out to be true. We thought when people got coverage, they'd stop going to the ER. That's just simply not what happens. They don't go see a primary care doctor and they drive up costs. So there's a coordination of care issue here. I'll just mention one thing. If I had a magic wand in healthcare that I think could get at some of these issues, is if we could incentivize patients to seek value. And there's a bill that actually passed and signed into law in Maine this past year that said that insurance companies offering plans to small businesses had to incentivize enrollees if they went to a value provider. Could be cash, gift card, reduced premium. Until we actually get the consumer engaged on some level, I think we're going to keep running into these brick walls.
Well, Josh Archambault is Senior Fellow on Healthcare Policy at the Pioneer Institute. Thank you so very much, Josh.
Thanks.
And Jim Welch, State Senator from West Springfield and Senate Chair of the Joint Committee on Healthcare Financing. Senator Welch, it was a privilege and great to have you on the program. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, the news that a wealthy single man has moved to the neighborhood means only one thing.
Oh, Mr. Bennet, how can you be so tiresome? You must know that I'm thinking of his marrying one of them.
Or a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife.
That's from the 1995 BBC version of Pride and Prejudice, starring Jennifer Ely as Elizabeth and, of course, Colin Firth as Mr. Darcy. Cue the Bridget Jones-esque collective swoon here. 200 years later, though, to the day after Jane Austen's death, her characters from Pride and Prejudice, Sense and Sensibility, Mansfield Park, and more still resonate for readers on the page and, of course, on the screen. So joining me now to talk about why is Whit Stillman. He directed the 2016 film Love and Friendship, an adaptation of Austen's short novel Lady Susan. He's also author of the book Love and Friendship, in which Jane Austen's Lady Susan Vernon is entirely vindicated. Whit Stillman, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks very much.
It's great to have you. You're from Paris, nonetheless. So thank you for joining us. Also with us from New York is Susan Greenfield. She's professor of literature at Fordham University, where she focuses on 18th century novels and on Jane Austen as well. Professor Greenfield, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. Are you a Jane Austen fan? What do you think of her? What's your favorite book or perhaps movie? And how did you discover Jane Austen? And what do her stories, what is the tale she tells? What do they mean to you? And why do you love them so much? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Whit Stillman, let me start with you, because I understand you are actually a convert to Jane Austen, that you perhaps aren't a lifelong lover of her work. Now, why is that?
Well, it's been almost lifelong now. I was a college sophomore in Cambridge, Mass., and very depressed, about to take a semester off to go to Mexico. And I picked up a copy of a Jane Austen novel and read it and thought it was terrible and thought she was horribly overrated and told everyone that. And the mistake I made was to start with Northanger Abbey, her send-up of Gothic novels, before I had any idea what a Gothic novel was. Fortunately, my elder sister clued me in, and 5 years later, I read Sense and Sensibility and loved Austen and read all the other books.
And now you've gone on to direct a film based on Austen's short novel. I mean, what was that process like?
Well, I actually had another more serious Jane Austen project, and I still hope to make that. But while I was reconsidering Northanger Abbey, because I said I'd probably been unfair to it, and I'd worked in publishing, editing Gothic novels, so I knew what she was speaking about. I went back to read Northanger Abbey and found in the back of a Penguin edition, Lady Susan. I thought it was just delightful material, sort of like an Oscar Wilde play. And unlike most books that weren't published by the authors, it was excellent. It was just in an inaccessible form, and I thought, by having it a film, I can make it more accessible.
Ah, okay. So we'll come back to that in a moment. But Professor Greenfield, I'm curious to hear sort of your personal relationship with Jane Austen. I mean, what's your story of how you came to her work and why you love it so much?
Well, I have to admit that I came to it as an adolescent, and I fell in love with the romance. But that evolved over time. As I grew older, I, you know, really appreciated her humor and her insight. And now as a scholar, I find myself fascinated by so many things, by her literary technique, by her narrative perspective, by her use of irony, and particularly by her satire of human greed and cruelty and her critique of the abuse of power, what we might call patriarchal power, but not only patriarchal power, class power, colonial power. She's more relevant than ever at this moment in history. And it's interesting, having listened just now to your report about healthcare, Jane Austen is extremely interested in the difference between people who care about other people's lives and those who don't.
Well, I mean, in a way, both of you sort of anticipated what was going to be one of my fundamental questions here is, like, of course, she died 200 years ago today, and her writing was, you know, superficially read as very much of her time. But what is it that gives her such staying power and resonates so profoundly with people like you and her, you know, millions of fans, even to this day? I mean, Whit Stillman, what do you think it is?
Well, I think sometimes at the beginning of a form, there is a greater excellence that's achieved later. I don't think there's always progress in form. So Jane Austen was, you know, in a sense, at the start of the modern novel, and she succeeded in this kind of perfection, a balance of wisdom and common sense and humor and of course romance. For me particularly, what I think I love about Jane Austen in addition to that is that she pervades a lot of the great thought of the late 18th century. Samuel Johnson, Dr. Johnson, and his group were very profound and wise people. And she referred to Dr. Johnson as my dearest Dr. Johnson. And a lot of her novels show the wisdom of that period. And there's kind of a direct connection in the sense that in Dr. Johnson's literary club was Dr. Burney and his daughter, Fanny Burney, who Dr. Johnson greatly liked. Was a model for Jane Austen. So there's sort of a literary line between them.
Mm. Well, I want to hear a clip from your adaptation, from your movie Love and Friendship, that sort of gives us a sense of this. And in this clip, we're going to hear Lady Susan, played by Kate Beckinsale. She's trying to convince her daughter, Frederica, to marry a wealthy and ridiculous suitor, Sir James. And, you know, if she does, it would make her financial future secure.
I fear and reproach myself, having shielded you for far too long. Had I let you starve a little bit more, you would resist much less.
Mama, I was often hungry at school.
Oh, evidently not hungry enough. In any case, the starvation of the schoolhouse is nothing like that of the destitute. Is that what you want?
No. I can see Sir James is a kind man, and if it weren't a matter of marriage, I'm sure I could like him. Marriage is for one's whole life.
Not in my experience.
A scene from Love and Friendship there. Susan Greenfield, I mean, respond to that, because a part of me wonders, Jane Austen in the dialogue and in the writing of her book is such a careful observer of the feeling and the emotion and the thinking surrounding, you know, social mores. And here we're in that clip, we heard Frank talk about money and marriage. I mean, did women of her time actually speak about these practicalities as frankly as they do in her books?
Well, of course, they were preoccupied with them. And I love Whit Stillman's movie. And that's a fantastic scene. But I did want to pursue this a little bit further, because I think, though, of course, Austen was a moment, you know, she represented her time, the 18th century. I think she remains timeless for other reasons. And I also don't think the novel has necessarily deteriorated as a form. One of the things I like to focus on when I teach something like Pride and Prejudice, for instance, is that it's very much about problems of mind and how the mind works and the manipulative power of romance. So, for instance, you know, in movies and in the kind of popular imagination about Austen today, all the emphasis is on, you know, love and how love works and heterosexual happiness, etc. But if you really pay attention to the novels, one of the things that's often clear is that the heroines spend very little time with the heroes, and that most of the time that they're falling in love, so to speak, they're actually preoccupied with their own thoughts and ideas. And so one of the things I like to say to my students is, how much is love? How much is marriage? How much is one's preoccupation with somebody else really about that person versus how much of it actually takes place in your own mind? And so there's a fantastic scene in Pride and Prejudice. It's the scene where I think Elizabeth Bennet actually falls in love with Mr. Darcy. It's when she's looking at a portrait of him. Mm. And she really hasn't liked him very much up until this moment. But she has heard what the housekeeper has said about Mr. Darcy, and she stares at this portrait. And by the end of the scene, the portrait is staring back at her. And she's invested the idea of Mr. Darcy with all of these fantastic qualities, some of which may or may not be true. And that idea is something that I think is extremely important for people to think about today. And that is, you know, where does love come from? How much of it is really about someone else?
Oh, interesting.
And while I appreciate the movies, and God knows I love Colin Firth and his wet T-shirt, et cetera, I don't know that the movies can capture to that extent the kind of interior preoccupation. And if I could say one other thing.
Well, actually, can I just interrupt you? Because I want to come back to the other point you want to make. But you've put a very interesting idea in front of us. And I just would love to ask Witt to respond, both as a lover of Austen's novels and a filmmaker who's presented with the challenge of adapting what Susan Greenfield so eloquently put now about the internal preoccupations that Austen wrestles with on the page. Like, how can you do you think that can be successfully done in film, Witt?
Yes, I think it's fascinating what she was saying. Really, really fascinating. I want to go back and read that scene now because I can't remember it.
It's a great scene.
It was very different in the case of Lady Susan, because this was in the epistolary format. So it's essentially monologues. It's essentially people stating things. And so that is very different than the problem, let's say, of adapting the other novels. And I had a brief connection to the project of Sense and Sensibility, another film I really liked, another adaptation I really liked, although it sort of made it more romantic and sweepingly romantic and beautiful than I think is in our minds when we're reading the novel, which is kind of great too. That in the original form of the adaptation, it was just the dialogue scenes, and what was missing was the predicament of those girls. Mm. So in the first two chapters of the novel is their incredibly touching predicament. And I think that makes, you know, it's part of the strength of Sense and Sensibility. These two girls are promised something, and then all that is withdrawn through the conversations between their elder brother and his wife, which is something that often happens in the families where the outsider wants the money. And, oh my gosh. And so.
It's okay. Modernity intrudes.
That would be a great scene to, that's a great scene to film too, because their conversation is so vicious.
Yeah. Well, so Susan Greenfield, respond to what Witt said, and then also I wanted to give you a chance to make the other point that you wanted to make before I so rudely interrupted a couple of minutes ago.
Well, I'm thinking about Sense and Sensibility, and the way I like the way you put it, Witt, if you don't mind if I call you Witt.
Please.
You know, that the predicament these heroines are in terms of being deprived of property, of status, dependent on, well, on people who are cruel and don't care about the lives of other people, right? And the way, one of the things that happens in that novel is that kind of dire socioeconomic predicament becomes morphed onto the problem of romance. So that Austen is really acutely aware of the way romance becomes a substitute or a way to kind of imagine one's way out of the kind of socioeconomic inequities that those girls are experiencing. So you know, and that's along the lines of the other point I want to make, which is that I think Austen is, you know, she's often seen particularly as kind of a novelist of social manners, and all of this is important. None of, you know, one thing isn't mutually exclusive, right? Mm-hmm. But she's very, very interested in the way power is abused and the kind of people who suffer in those situations, and also in the basic questions of who can actually extend themselves to think about the lives of other people versus who cannot. In a novel like Mansfield Park, which is much debated among scholars, is arguably, and I think actually, and many others would agree, it's about the problem of slavery. Even though slavery doesn't appear in the foreground of the novel, the patriarch in that family has a slave plantation. And the way he treats family members, and particularly the way he treats the heroine, reflects the kind of abuse that may be going on out of sight of the novel. Hmm. Or something like Pride and Prejudice, where, you know, the emphasis is on the problem of happiness and marriage. But, and this speaks to Witt's point earlier about thinking about the novels in historical context. Well, the whole idea of happiness at this point in history is tied in with revolutionary thinking.
Right.
Pride and Prejudice is just
sort of
you know.
This is sort of an odd I find this kind of an odd version of Jane Austen because she was sort of a passionate anti-Jacobin Tory. Quite critical of the poor and the lives of the poor. I couldn't disagree more.
When
Fanny goes back to her home, there's a kind of shrinking from the sort of vulgarity and the
crudeness.
And I think in her other writings, it was quite clear that she was, you know, passionately against the French Revolution and
I couldn't disagree more. And I suggested you read a book by Claudia Johnson called Women, Politics, and the Novel. When Fanny goes back to Portsmouth and she sees her family and has this very negative, very classist view of them, that scene is arguably ironic. I mean, one of the things Fanny is thinking at that moment is how wonderful Mansfield Park is, when Mansfield Park has been an absolutely horrible place for her. I don't think one can just categorically pigeonhole Jane Austen as a Tory who didn't care about the poor. Jane Austen praised Thomas Clarkson's abolitionist tract.
So if I may, I just want to jump, forgive me for just jumping in here, because... In a way, the nature and the occurrence of this disagreement or between the two of you, I think speaks to how alive Austen's work is even to this day, right? I mean, honestly, I just sat back for a moment and listened and tried to follow along here. I mean, what's the core disagreement the two of you are having, or whether or not Jane Austen felt certain compassion for the poor, for the disenfranchised?
Let me just say something. The debate we're having is actually a classic debate. Mm. Wit represents a very, well-known and well-respected point of view about Austen. And my position has been shaped by other kinds of critics. But you are seeing in action or on the radio the kind of debates that people do tend to have about Austen and that people really disagree about. So, well, of course, I think I'm right. that doesn't mean that Witt is wrong.
Well, I think also that, you know, like any good person who's sort of striving to do the right thing in the world, Jane Austen changed her attitudes towards things. So, I mean, I think she did come from what we consider a rather conservative background with her brothers who were influential for her in the roles of either future admirals of the British Navy or clergymen in the established Church of England or a very wealthy man who is an heir and sort of supported his sisters. And I think her attitude towards religion is sort of interesting in this case because she's really quite devout. She wrote prayers. And initially, when the evangelical movement started, she was a little bit dismissive of it and contemptuous of it. And both she and her brother then became friendlier to it and more sympathetic to it.
Well, Whit, if I may jump in here, because we are flat out of time, and forgive me for having to jump in here. But I think what you were describing in terms of Jane Austen's own evolution of some of her views is part of the reason why her work today still feels so contemporary and animates even the disagreements and discussions like we're having today. And I'm very grateful to both of you for joining us. Whit Stillman, director of the film Love and Friendship, he joined us today via Skype. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And Susan Greenfield, professor of literature at Fordham University. Professor Greenfield, a true pleasure to have you. Thank you so much as well.
Thank you. And let me just put in the final word here. I think people should be open-minded to the possibilities of Austen's complicated politics.
Well put. And of course, on the 200th anniversary of Jane Austen's death. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and one of my favorite people is with me now in the studio, Evan Horowitz. He writes the quick study column for the Boston Globe. Evan, it's good to have you back.
It's great to be here.
Okay, now during the break, you told me something that I did not know about you, that before you wrote for the Globe, you were a professor of 19th century literature.
I was, and I used to teach classes on literature and film. So
you had a reaction to our conversation about Jane Austen just now.
I had several. I was outside the studio jumping up and down.
What? Because
mostly
was she a revolutionary or not?
Oh, I'm definitely on the she was a Tory side of this debate.
Okay.
Partly that's just love of Whit Stillman too, though.
Okay, so I'm going to think that maybe would Jane Austen have thought that income inequality today is it a problem or not? Would she have cared?
She was very concerned about downward mobility. But inequality less so.
All right. Well, so let's talk about policy prescriptions for upward mobility in the United States. Because in your most recent article for the Boston Globe, you wrote about how for generations we've been thinking that more education and more jobs are the policy prescriptions for fixing poverty in the United States. But it hasn't worked. Okay, so why? Because really, that's all most policymakers say. More education, more jobs.
And it makes a certain amount of sense. I mean, how could it not work? You get more people through college. They should have more skills that would make them able to take more jobs or move between jobs and make them less vulnerable to falling into poverty. So there's nothing wrong with the rationale, except that it hasn't played out that way.
Right.
We do have lots more college grads, about three times as many college grads in the workforce as we had 30 years ago, and exactly the same poverty rate.
Yeah, I mean, you wrote that overall the poverty rate in the U.S. is stagnant, between 11 and 15% of the total population for the past 40 years.
Basically since Social Security. That was the last time we saw a real drop in poverty was the introduction of Social Security.
But on the other hand, we've seen profound changes in the workforce of the United States.
This is true. Women entering the workforce in record numbers, changes to the welfare program to make sure more people take jobs rather than get checks. And so, yeah, we've had a big increase in the number of working age people in the labor force. And again, no change in poverty. This just doesn't seem to be the magic bullet people want it to be.
Okay, so but why though? Because again, it makes intuitive sense, but it's not being borne out in actual results.
Right. So I think there are a couple of reasons. One is that people overestimate the number of potential workers living in poverty. You think, well, they're in poverty, they should get jobs. But half of the people living in poverty are seniors, kids, people with disabilities. Another big chunk are full-time caretakers. So they take care of their kids or they take care of their parents. And yeah, they could go to work, but then they'd have to pay for daycare and end
up as a
wash. Or we'd
be going back to child labor, right? For the children living in
poverty. So a big portion of them just live too far away from the labor force to be really changed or transformed by education or jobs. And the other problem is, as more people have gone during this exact same period, when more people were moving through the labor force, wages have stagnated. So it's very easy today to go and get a job and earn poverty wages.
Okay. So, but of course, in this respect, in terms of the number and who lives in poverty in the United States, the U.S. is quite different than other developed countries, right? I mean, you write about, for example, this concept known as market poverty. What does that mean?
So when you're – there are two ways to think about poverty. There's the – well, how big is your paycheck? Is your paycheck big enough to get you over the poverty line or not? That's sort of market poverty. You go, you get a job, what's your paycheck like? But then that's not really what scholars mean by poverty in the international setting. What they mean is after your paycheck, plus after you pay taxes, plus after you get whatever benefits you might get from the government, how about then are you still below the poverty line? So there's two different ways to think about it, and the U.S. looks totally different on the two measures. On market poverty, that is the, hey, are your paychecks big enough? We look like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Like all those European nations that you think of as being places of low poverty, you know, in Scandinavia or in France or in Germany. No, the poverty rates there, the market poverty rates there are basically the same as they are here. But then once you factor in taxes
and benefits,
all of a sudden, their poverty rates are cut in half, and ours is virtually unchanged.
What are the most? What are the biggest differences in the benefits that track with the difference in poverty?
So, the biggest ones are pension benefits and child and parenting benefits. So that for a lot of these countries, and look at the child poverty rate. Like in the U.S., something like 1 in 5 children live in poverty. In the best performing European nations, it's more like 1 in 20 children, and that's because if you have children, you get a nice package of benefits from the government to support your child. It's food, it's some education, it's clothing, it's, well, eventually daycare, all manner of supports.
So, I mean, kind of at the basis of what you write in the Globe today is this idea that solutions to truly tackle poverty have to involve some sort of combination of taxes, and you write about redistribution and government programs. I mean, just even that word, I'm hearing doors all down the halls of Congress slamming in your face.
I know, this is the problem. And, you know, it would be nice if the other solution worked, the market solution. I'm not out here to justify redistribution because I have some predisposition. But no. It's that we tried the market solution and it doesn't work. It's that no country has built a market economy where you can get rid of poverty just based on people's paychecks. Lots and lots of people have tried it. The only thing that seems to work is the redistribution approach.
Mm. Well, Evan Horowitz brings the data and the analysis through his quick study column to us here at Radio Boston. He's a columnist for the Boston Globe. We have a link to his latest article titled Why More Jobs and Degrees Won't Reduce Poverty. And again, we discovered that you are a former 19th century professor, a professor of 19th century literature. Your talents know no end.
No, I'm always happy to talk about Baudelaire or Dickens anytime.
Oh, well, speaking of poverty. Okay, thanks, Evan.
Thank you.
This is Radio Boston.